If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I'm Patrick.
And I'm Jillian.
We've been making the True Crime Obsessed podcast for almost 9 years now.
Yeah, each week on TCO, we tell a riveting true crime story by recapping a documentary about the case.
With nearly 400 million downloads and over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, we can say with confidence that if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now might be the time to give us a try.
We cover the cases everyone is talking about and also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
Find True Crime Obsessed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
20 years after Scott Peterson was branded one of the most hated men in America, the cheating husband who dumped his pregnant wife in the San Francisco Bay, the LA Innocence Project has thrown a legal grenade into that story. And we've talked about this last year when this started. It continues on this year. They filed a 600-page post-conviction petition that doesn't just question his guilt. It accuses police and prosecutors of destroying evidence, hiding witnesses, and building a case on bad science. The petition claims the state's own expert has recanted. Key evidence was torched after a secret meeting, and 15 witnesses who saw Lacey alive were ignored. If even half of what in this filing actually holds up, California may have to ask itself a very uncomfortable question. Did they go after the wrong guy? Did they execute a character instead of proving a murderer? Bob Mata, defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries, joins us to discuss these new filings with the LA Innocence Project, all of the new data that has come to light, the new accusations that are being made against the principle of the story itself. Bob, there's a lot here, and I want to work our way through it, but I want to get your take on this. What drew you into this? What made you go, oh, maybe there is something here initially as a defense attorney?
Probably the length of the petition.
Yeah.
When I saw that it was 600 pages, I knew that they had done some serious work. So, and this thing dropped in August and I hadn't really looked at it because it was massive. And then I told Allison, who's my co-host over on our channel, I'm like, we got to look at this thing and see if it's got any legs. And we did. And, you know, the one thing that we like to explain to people initially is that there are many, many, many Innocence Project organizations around the United States. So this was not the Innocence Project. Yeah. This is the LA Innocence Project. I think that Scott Peterson's sister happens to work with them. So there were some things where you know, people can say, oh, well, she's a crackpot. I would probably argue that she's just passionate about, you know, her brother in the case. So, I mean, that could be looked at both ways. But ultimately, yeah, the length of it is what really drew me in, because I figured that there had to be some new stuff that they pulled up. And, you know, right away when, and I'm sure we're going to talk about it, with their first claim, you know, it kind of sucked me. And so from there moving forward, it's, it was worth a look.
And I'm going to say to everybody, just, you know, for a moment, I mean, this is a very emotionally charged story where a lot of people, they get in Nancy Grace mode, where it's like, you're evil, you're the devil. Okay, just take a step back for a moment and let's just look. Let's do the what if scenario this. And that's what we're going to do, because we can, after we do it, everyone can take a breath back and go, okay, let's compare that to this. And make the decisions in. But it's important to be able to consume the information without pushing it all back immediately. So let's do that. Let's start with what they're saying was false scientific evidence. And that starts with the gestational age of baby Connor. The prosecution's star expert, Dr. DeVore, Dr. Terry DeVore testified in 2004 that fetal growth data proved Lacey and baby Connor died on or before December 24th of 2002, the day that Scott had gone fishing. In 2024, shown modern NIH and WHO fetal growth standards by defense expert Dr. Peter Dubay of Harvard, DeVore recanted his original statements under oath. He now says that the new data shows Connor died approximately what he believes to be January 1st through the 5th, when Scott was already under police surveillance, making him physically incapable of committing the murders. Let's talk about that piece right there. Does it make him physically incapable of committing the murders? I mean, this is a big piece, if it in fact can be proven, and you have an original expert now coming back and saying, I might have been wrong.
Yeah, I think. Oh, sorry. Go.
I mean, what is that? What I mean, we saw that recently in the Ellen Greenberg case with the medical examiner saying I might have been wrong. What is the? Does this change anything here with the original expert even coming back and saying this?
Yeah, and I think another thing that I want to add to kind of your know, everybody take a breath. Everybody just, you know, we're not freeing Scott Peterson based on this thing, even though there is an actual innocence claim, which is claim 14. The reality is that thing's not getting granted. They're not just walking him out of prison. The best that could happen is that he's going to get an evidentiary hearing, which I know we're going to talk about. But I just want people to understand that really what this thing is about is, did he get a fair trial? It's not so much about innocence or guilt, okay?
Yes.
It's evaluating whether or not this dude got a fair trial. And as we know, every single citizen in this country, if you are arrested, you have an absolute unequivocal right to a fair trial in this country. Mm-hmm. So that's what this evaluation is. So while people may
Good
be
point.
Curious, right? All right, so as far as DeVore goes, in and of itself, it's not enough, because I think that the counter argument from the state, if they're forced to respond to this, which is going to be the first step in this thing, is whether or not it's a definitive time in terms of even with the DeVore's recantation, because he essentially initially said, that in his estimation, based on the femur length, which was at 64.5 millimeters in 1984, there was a study that was done, and that's what he was relying on. So this is a 2004 case. He's relying on some really old research. And obviously what happened in the interim is there's been better research that's come out, as we know, our scientific methods and techniques and, all of the science improves over time. We see it with basically every area, especially with DNA.
We've improved in half a century, basically.
Exactly. So, you know, when they come out with this new kind of gestational age and the study now says that Connor's gestational age equals 34 weeks, whereas with DeVore initially, it was 33 weeks and one day, okay? Mm-hmm. So now it's 34 weeks and 6 days. So that would put the date of death at January 5th of 2003, okay? or two, I'm sorry, 2000. Well, yeah, actually 2003, because it would have switched into the next year.
Mm-hmm.
So they then, after they come up with this, with the new expert, they then go back to DeVore. And as you said, they said, here, man, like this is the new data. This is the new. Okay. This is what you need to be looking at. He looks at it and he absolutely turns around and says, yes, that changes my opinion. And he goes so far as to write an affidavit. And he says, if I were to testify today, this would be my new testimony. So kind of the mean or median date of death, if you kind of stick it right in between the two, his original date of the 23rd and now the 5th, well, you'd stick it at January 1st, 23rd. Mm-hmm. So why is that significant? Well, it's significant because Peterson's truck and boat was impounded on the 26th of December, never returned. Peterson was under constant police and media surveillance after the 24th of December. And there's no evidence that Peterson could have committed the crimes on December 28th or later. I mean, the guy was under the microscope.
Yeah.
So what it really does is it completely undermines prosecution's timeline theory, which is big, you know.
Yeah.
But now, will the state, if this goes to an evidentiary hearing, find their own expert and say that this is incorrect? Probably. You know, that's why this would become an issue for a jury, an issue of fact for a jury to figure out, all right, who do I find? But I'm telling you, having the guy that one of the jurors unequivocally said, for me, the Dr. DeVore's testimony about the Connor's age was the smoking gun. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, like he was seen as a very, very powerful witness for them. And if you've got the guy who testified for the state now testifying for the defense and recanting what he said, then it's going to be impactful because they're going to be able to get that on, you know, and they're going to be able to get him on. So, I mean, that in and of itself, that one piece is significant in terms of, again, thinking about what did he get a fair trial? If that was incorrect in terms of the information and you've got the doctor who testified to it and he's now saying, yeah, I screwed up. You have to take that into consideration in terms of whether or not he got a fair trial.
It essentially would mean that Lacey was still alive for longer than what the original timeline was, meaning that Scott didn't kill them on or before the 24th, out on his little boating expedition, that someone else or somebody or something else killed them and then put them out in the lake, when it would have been impossible for Scott to have done that because he was already under surveillance, that basically they would have already been missing, or she would have already been missing. She was pregnant. It wasn't like they were carting this child around. The baby was in her. Right. And she would have essentially, it's looking at the possibility that, well, was she abducted? Was she still alive, still carrying the baby for this extra basically week? And then she was dropped in the lake. That would be, I mean, that's a kind of a big thing. But like you said, are they going to find another expert that's going to say, well, there's room for error here? We are talking 33 weeks to 34 weeks and 4 days in a gestational period. I am not an expert in this area whatsoever, but I don't, is there room for error there? Do we all grow at slightly different rates a little bit? I mean, could that be just kind of on average, this is where it would be, but I mean, do we have a starting point on the science, or do we have a starting point knowing this is exactly where the baby was on December 23rd or 24th, as to be able to compare it, you know, with what it would be if we're at 34 weeks and 4 days? Do we even have that measurement? Is that something that like is medically available from her, you know, OBGYN or anything when she was, you know, getting her checkups and things of that nature?
Yeah, I mean, there's studies out there. You know, I mean, the new studies, there was studies between 2014 and I think it was 2022, and there's this Intergrowth 21st and NICHD, which respectively were 2015, 2022. And there was another 2017 study talking about the longitudinal studies tracking thousands of pregnant women with modern ultrasound. Mm-hmm. And so what DuBlay does is he uses the new studies. That's how he comes up with the 34 weeks and 6 days. I mean, naturally there's going to be argument that is not like that January 5th is not a in stone date. The point is here, you know, yes, there can be movement in there, right? I mean, like I don't know that you're going to be able to pinpoint a day, but what this does is it pinpoints a time frame, which puts it past the 23rd. So, because the 23rd is what had them just
alive.
Right. I mean, he's alive. He's got the ability to be able to do what they're saying that he did. So just moving that, you know, goalpost down the field a bit is creating in the defense's estimation a potential for reasonable doubt.
Yeah.
You know, so and like I said, the state will put on their own expert. They'll say, well, you know, it could have been as early as the 23rd, you know, based on, you know, just all these different factors. So I'm sure that they'll find somebody who'll say that. But when you have somebody that's going to be able to counter it this time, and you have the guy who said that it was on the 23rd the first time testifying on behalf of Scott Peterson, it's going to be impactful with the jury. It just will be. And then ultimately it's up to the jury to decide. Mm-hmm. Now they're going to look at all the other evidence that we're going to go through and talk about. But I mean, for a jump off point, it's a pretty strong way for the defense to be able to start.
I've got a question. So I followed this case quite extensively as it was happening, because how could you not? It was everywhere. It was on every tabloid. It was on every news show. They're always talking about this.
Yep.
So my question now, with some of this evidence that's come out, is it possible that maybe Scott he wasn't the one who physically killed her, but what if he set it up because he had this other relationship? She had a baby in her that he didn't want to have. He wanted out of the marriage. This was the easiest way to do it. So maybe he set it up. So maybe he didn't physically do it. Could he have behind the scenes set it up for her to be killed?
So you're asking if he could have hired somebody to do it.
Correct.
So, I mean, I'm assuming that they could certainly use that, but I mean, they're going to have to look at the banking records.
Sure.
I mean, because one thing that comes along with, as we know from the Adelson case, is that you have to pay hitmen, right?
Right.
You know,
layaway plans. I mean, come on. They had the blue light special over there. You know,
they didn't have Venmo back then.
Yeah, no Venmo. And, you know, the reality is that Scott and Lacey had a joint account, you know, like the with the boat thing, which I'm sure we're going to talk about.
Right.
Like, that money came out of the joint account. You know, that was a big thing that she didn't know about the boat. You know, they've gone to great lengths to prove that was incorrect. You know, Scott had said that she had been out to the warehouse where he had stored the boat on the 20th of December. There's another witness that verified that she was there, and the boat would have been like unmissable if she was there, you know. So, but in terms of whether or not, I think that they'd be able to prove up that it was Scott paying for somebody to do it, which the end result legally is that it's as if he did it. So there's no difference, because that was always my theory on Murdoch. Like, I just thought that Murdoch hired a couple of meth heads to do this because he couldn't actually do it, but he wanted it done just because he didn't want to have to deal with the aftermath of all the shit that was coming down the pike. So, you know, I mean, I don't know that they'd be able to kind of show the money side of it just because they had all the bank accounts. They had all that stuff. You know what I mean? And I'm sure at least one cop, like, was able to peek just a little bit outside of the tunnel that they were all looking in and be like, well, what happens if it wasn't him and it was but he hired somebody? You know, somebody must have thought of that must have popped in somebody's head.
It's like, could he have, I mean, anything could pop, but is there any evidence to point in that direction? No.
Yeah.
There isn't anything in that case that points that way. I think would be, you know, another point of this, the oceanography, we're getting into oceanography on this. The point of where the bodies were found, false oceanography evidence anchored at Brooks Island. The prosecution expert David Chang testified currents proved that Lacey's body was dumped where Scott fished. A 2024 hydrodynamics analysis by Dr. Fagan of Texas A&M using Army Corps software showed bodies dumped there where they claim the bodies were dumped, or the body of Lacey was dumped with Connor inside of her, would not have drifted north. It would have drifted north, not south. And modeling shows the remains were placed at the Albany Bulb, accessible by land, consistent with third-party disposal. Not exactly Scott's boat, which is another thing. I mean, we're talking about currents, and they certainly do play a big role in where things end up when you dump things in water. To back this up now and say, well, again, it's another big piece of the theory of what happened. And if he dumped the body over here, then it naturally went that way. And the jury was told, well, they would have floated this way. But actual data, actual facts that show where the currents were going proves that wrong. That's another, I guess, feather in the cap of the defense of Scott Peterson 2.0.
Yeah. I mean, Chang testified that essentially that the bodies anchored right were, you know, right in the middle distance between Berkeley Marina and Brooks Island, precisely where Peterson was fishing on the 24. So again, you know, and if you listen to any of the jurors, and the prosecution argued this, they're saying, hey, look, if Dr. Chang is to be believed, then Scott Peterson is a murderer. It's as simple as that. And, you know, there's a juror on record saying it's exactly where he was fishing is where the bodies turned up. That was the bottom line. So, yes, that was a pivotal piece of evidence for the prosecution in this case. So, you know, the problem with Chang's methodology in terms of what the defense's expert is saying is that he ignored those tidal currents, saying that they would not play a role, and they would. And he used predictive wind data, not actual measured data. He never studied body movement in the water. He couldn't reproduce the trajectory for Lacey's body. And he also admitted on the stand that there were large uncertainties and that error bars could be substantial. And, you know, in his 2012 declaration, he acknowledged if bodies moved at different times, the anchor point could have been different. So he backtracked a little bit too. And, you know, Fagan, who is the defense's new expert, he did this this new flow modeling thing, this 3D flow modeling, and he built this state-of-the-art like hydrodynamic model, and it's using like historical wind, tide, and like freshwater discharge data, and this was not available in 2004. Again,
sure.
We're seeing new technology that is just available now and is going to give us better results and more accurate results and more trustworthy results. And the key finding is that water movement in that part of the bay is that it's always nearly always counterclockwise towards the northwest. Mm-hmm. So ultimately what that would mean is that where they're claiming the body would have been found, or they would have actually drifted, which is that Albany Bulb area, it was never searched. It's too shallow for boats. And, you know, they're also arguing as to that Lacey's pants had like pink staining, and they thought that would have been from red algae. Okay. Mm-hmm. And red algae is a very predominant plant species between Albany Bulb and Point Isabel, where Lacey was recovered. Mm-hmm. And so there was no evidence whatsoever that Peterson fished at Albany Bulb. And Albany Bulb also had land access, meaning that you didn't need a boat to get bodies in the water. So, I mean, again, this thing is effective in the sense that it completely contradicts the prosecution's theory in terms of that Scott dumped the bodies. You know, and I've seen, there's still one online, one of these YouTube videos where they have, because Lacey being 8 months pregnant at the time, I think her weight was 150. Okay. In the prosecution's theory, they were also talking about these four anchors, these concrete anchors that they're claiming that Scott made in his, you know, anchor factory at his warehouse. And, you know, those all add like 12 pounds. And then you've got Scott, who's over, you know, 200 pounds. And, you know, so there's this guy who's got, you know, probably just it's a dummy that they weighed out to be 150, the approximate weight mm-hmm. of Lacey. They put it in an identical boat to what Scott had. They had where Scott would have to be standing in order to get 150 pounds over the side. And people understand, like, if you don't know what Scott's boat looked like, Google it. Mm-hmm. This is a small fishing boat. This isn't a big boat. This is a very small boat where you've got the outboard motor, you know, and you're sitting back and you know.
It's a small boat.
It's a very small boat. So, you know, and it's got kind of the bench seats, you know, it's got mm-hmm. like three bench mm-hmm. seats, you know, with these gaps in between. So in theory, in the state's theory, Lacey would have had to have been in between, you know, one of the seats, one of the bench seats, and he'd have to be standing there, you know, kind of lugging her up and getting her to be able to kind of shove her over the side of the boat. The problem is, if you've got her anchored, you've got that additional weight on her, and you've got Scott all on one side of this boat, the boat is taking on water, at least
should be,
right? You know, because it's that small of a boat, to the point where the thing submerges. So again, and if this guy gets a new trial, you could bet your ass they're going to recreate that again, you know, because it's powerful. It's powerful mm-hmm. evidence. And you know, the thing that, like, I always thought the counter argument is, how fucking stupid do you have to be to make your alibi where you're dumping the bodies? Because there was no mystery. Right. Scott was always very honest about where he was fishing. Exactly. Mm-hmm. They saw him get into the marina because there's a card thing that you have to put in and there's a gate that goes up. They know he was there. Like, mm-hmm. what kind of fucking moron?
Let me ask
his wife's body, his pregnant wife's body, in the place that he's fishing, when ultimately he would have to know that he's going to be looked at as the perpetrator here. And you would, like, even if you know nothing about anything in terms of the ocean and oceanography, you're going to think, well, fuck, man, the tide, if for whatever reason she surfaces, is going to pull her back in. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it's just. And you would think that they're also going to dive around there.
Let me ask you this in terms of the timeline, because this is making sense in my head. Tell me if it's accurate. He said, we knew early on, we knew right when the investigation started, when he reported the missing and all that, it came out pretty quickly that he said he was out there fishing, right? That was publicly available knowledge.
Yes.
At the beginning of this investigation. So yes. If someone else did do this, if someone abducted Lacey and then killed her several days later, they already knew where to dump her to make it look like Scott did it.
It's an interesting point.
So. Yeah. I mean, it's the main point, you know, if the Medina burglary people had anything to do with it and this thing blasted all over, it was absolutely put out there immediately, you know, in terms of what his alibi was. So it
kills this whole story of, I think a lot of, and I too have sat on it too, where it's like, yeah, but I mean, he went fishing out here and there's the anchors and there's all this. Yes, but that was all publicly available. And if you already abducted and you're going to kill this woman and you don't want it to look like you and you want your suspect that's already built into this, go dump the bodies where he said he was.
100%.
But how many burglars turn into murderers? I mean, if they were just looking for some jewels or something, would they have turned into abductors / murderers? I mean, what are the odds?
That's a great point. And no, I mean, typically if they're in the house, and the reason that they're burglarizing homes on December 24th,
right,
is because people are out of town. Like, they don't want conflict. They're just coming in to steal shit.
It's like Home Alone.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly. Which is what I've always pictured these two guys as being, you know, Daniel Stern and Joe Pesci, mm-hmm. you know, like just like two bumbling fools.
Yeah.
But I think what ultimately the theory was that they were in the process. They were out by the van. Lacey approaches them and is like, what the fuck are you doing? You know, are you burglarizing this house? I'm calling the police. And like that forced them to grab her into the van in order not to get busted. So I, you know, and ultimately,
yeah. And I want to,
Yeah,
I want to talk about that because that's another big part here. There's newly surfaced witness RZ in a 2024 sworn affidavit confessed to participation in the December 24th Medina burglary, which was across the street from the Peterson home. He says now that a pregnant woman with a dog matching Lacey confronted them. Burglar Stephen Todd, he said, this is a claim, that he threatened her to go home. That places Lacey alive after Scott left and links her disappearance to the burglars, not to Scott. And the mindset of this, I think, is important, too, because the other argument, I had this conversation yesterday off the air about, well, why, if you were a pregnant woman, if you were anybody for that matter, and you see your neighbor's home being burglarized, are you going to go and approach them? Are you going to go, what are you guys doing? I'm going to call the police. I don't think so. But I don't know that Lacey thought it was a burglary. If I'm out walking my dog in my neighborhood and I see a van and they're taking stuff out of a home, but it doesn't look like, you know, masked people and it doesn't look ominous. It just looks like, well, maybe people are moving or something. That's what would go through my mind immediately is like, oh, are they moving? Are you? I would not be thinking it was criminal. I would be thinking, oh, what's going on? And just in a very friendly way, like, hey, what you guys up to? Just neighborly conversation. And then maybe very quickly she realizes, oh shit, this is not just, you know, they're not moving somebody off to college here or something. This is something else. She goes back in and we have a couple burglars here in this scenario. And we have to, for a moment, not put them all together in terms of, well, they're all going to be doing the exact same thing and they're all agreeing to the exact same way of handling this situation. You may have some that went on their way and knew, and okay, well, the neighbor might have seen us, but whatever, we got out of there. And you may have one that went back and thought, we got to get rid of that bitch because she saw us and right. I don't care what they think, but I'm not going to get caught and I'm going to do what I'm going to do about this.
Right.
And that could easily explain why the other burglars, you know, can easily swear up and down and say, no, we didn't do anything to her whatsoever. There's several of them. One of them could have made that decision. It didn't have to be a collective choice by the group.
Yeah, 100%. You know, and RZ would be the third burglar, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, like, and this guy doesn't come forward until January of 2025.
Mm-hmm. After the Netflix special.
Yes. So, yeah. You know, it's kind of a weird thing to come forward on if you weren't involved. You know what I mean? It's like I'm trying to understand like where this guy's motive would be to inject himself into this situation where he's never had any ramifications from it, you know, and we're 21 years after the trial.
He's essentially injecting himself to something where he could have ramifications.
Yes.
About it.
He would absolutely have ramifications.
It doesn't mean that he's just going to be like, well, I had nothing to do with this murder, but maybe this happened over. Like, you are going to be looked at closely. Just because you're saying this aloud doesn't mean what you're saying is accurate. Because it can also be looked at as, I'm not saying he did this, but I am saying if you have a guilty conscience, sometimes just pieces of the truth slip out, just little nuggets. And if you want someone else to get caught for this, even though it might be you, you may put little nuggets out there. So I'm going to drive the narrative over here because it looks like people might be getting a little too close to the sun over here, which could be the truth. There's a lot of ways that could be taking place. And it's a very odd behavior, 22 years plus, to come out and make this statement when your life has moved on and you have, you know,
you're in the clear.
You're in the clear.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. Because look, there's a statute of limitations on burglary, meaning
not on murder.
That's right. There's no statute, because this would be felony murder. You're in the commission of committing another felony and a murder happens. Doesn't matter if it's by your hand. If you're with a crew, if somebody kills that person, you're on the fucking hook as if you pulled the trigger yourself or whatever the means was by which Lacey ended up dying. So, yeah, I mean, RZ's statement is weird. I mean, you know, it's again like his quote is a pregnant lady from across the street came over and confronted them.
Yeah.
Which, is a little more that, you know, I mean, if Lacey's walking around, she's 8 months pregnant, she's probably feeling safe in her neighborhood. Mm-hmm. There's probably a lot of eyes out there, you know, and she probably been like, well, what are you guys doing? Because, you know, they took the safe out of the house.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't just them with a bag with candlesticks and the silver, you know, I mean, they're like moving the safe out of the house.
Yeah.
And, you know, if she goes up to him, she's like, what are you doing? And like you said, T, they're like, go home. You didn't see shit. You know, yeah. The dog's barking. And, you know, at that point, you've got to look at RZ's statement. There's Todd, who's one of the other burglars. He makes a call from inside the Medina's home asking mm-hmm. for help. They call this Adam Tenbrink asking to help for getting stuff out of the house. And Todd tells Adam that they were seen by somebody during the burglary. And by the time Todd calls Adam, he'd already burglarized the house several times, meaning in and out.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So then Pierce, who's the other guy, told the defense investigator, Carl Jensen, that Todd started the burglary on December 24th and then returned with Pierce for the safe on the 25th, not December 26th. And so when Pierce reported to the jail to serve the sentence, he was told that he did not need to serve any time. So that's weird. And then you got Medina's declaration from 2023. And he's saying that they saw mail sticking out of the mailbox on December 25th. Medina told an officer that the burglary occurred December 24th because no mail would be sticking out on December 25th or 26th. Right. So they left before the mailman came on December 24th.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that that morning he saw a suspicious white male on a bicycle, a flannel shirt, slowly riding past, and then he circled the block to check. And then Susan, his wife, you know, her 2023 declaration is that police detective told her that one of the burglars admitted to making a call from inside her home, and then she corroborates the other account of Todd calling from inside the house. All right, so. You know, I mean, which you're going to be able to look at the fucking phone bills, man. You're going to see mm-hmm. when the phone calls. And again, the significance of this is that the state had this on the 26th. Mm-hmm. You know, they said this happened on the 26th. And, you know, this is a big point of contention here because
there
the 26th
is,
you know, that takes away any kind of third party suspect argument by the defense. You know, Garagos continued to try to argue and did fervently throughout the trial. But, you know, I mean, the state did a very effective job in moving that date to the 26th.
So Jeannie in our chat brought up an interesting point, and I do remember this, and I just want to throw it out there. Didn't he tell his girlfriend, I forget her name right now off the top of my head, that he was a widower? I mean, he was setting up this weird story.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody else in our chat mentioned too that didn't Scott say that he was initially golfing? I don't quite remember that detail.
But that's bullshit to a girl. It doesn't have anything. It doesn't really matter what he told the girl. He's not going to be like, well, I'm cheating on my wife. I'm out golfing. I'm doing. I mean, he also said he was like in Paris or something too.
True.
I mean, it's just bullshit. It has nothing to do with that's Scott's set of lies to keep his relationship bullshit afloat.
Right.
It doesn't really connect to the actual murder itself. Or the disappearance of Lacey. Now, it's completely fucked up that your wife is missing if you had nothing to do with this and you're still trying to maintain this ongoing affair over here. That says a lot about your mental state and how fucked up you are in the head, that you're not just like, fuck this affair right now. Like, I just need some time away. Like, no, I'm going to actively keep doing this. That shows a total fucked up personality disorder.
Yeah.
But it doesn't necessarily tie into his alibi, because those alibis weren't to police. They were to a girl that in her world has no idea any of this shit's going on around him.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I think,
And it's not just your wife, it's your 8-month pregnant
and
wife.
And your 8-month pregnant wife. Right. Yes. Right. I mean, it shows like quite a fucked up brain if you're able to do that. We're talking with Bob Mata, defense attorney, about the Scott Peterson case and the new filings with the LA Innocence Project that are trying to argue that Scott Peterson did not do this and that there was a lot of errors in this investigation, a lot of errors in this trial. You have evidence, you have people who made original statements, recanting them, and a lot of new things coming to light, and we're breaking it all down. And I want to get your guys' thoughts in the comment section as we continue to break this down. I want to talk about some of the false police testimony that was brought into the trial, the petition that has been filed with the LA Innocence Project, listing 15 witnesses, including 5 who personally knew Lacey, who saw her walking her dog between 9:45 and 11:30 a.m. on December 24th. Police reports confirming this were allegedly buried or altered. One cop later admitted witnesses were turned away. That's not how you do an up and up investigation. You don't just bury shit that doesn't go with the narrative of what you are going to want to convince the jury of. That's how cases like this get really fucked up and set guilty people free because you wanted to push your narrative to be right at that moment in time. And that's what some of that really feels like, Bob.
Yeah, no doubt, man. I mean, there were a lot of people that claimed that they saw Lacey. And it wasn't all strangers. Like 5 mm-hmm. of these witnesses were people that knew Lacey and knew what she looked like mm-hmm. and were unequivocal that it was her. And the cops quite simply just said, nope, wrong person. Like, you didn't see her. Mm-hmm. We got the guy. That's impossible that you saw her because she was already dead. You know? So, it's completely ignored by law enforcement, which is mm-hmm. again, like when we go back and we talk about that thing that you were just talking about, Tony, where like you look at this dude who's only been dating or whatever, fucking this chick Amber for 14 days. Mm-hmm. This isn't like this is some 6-month or a year long affair.
Yeah.
You know, this is like a 14 day fling. His wife's fucking pregnant. And law enforcement's looking at this guy like exactly how you described it. Like, that is so fucked up. Mm-hmm. Like, that after she goes missing, you're still trying to keep that thing afloat. This fucking guy did it. Like mm-hmm. in anybody's mind, that's why he's so detested. Like, if that doesn't exist in the world, and I'm talking about the Amber shit after Lacey goes missing.
Right.
Because mm-hmm. it's one thing to have an affair beforehand. That's bad. It's fucking awful, right? Your pregnant wife, what kind of scumbag does that? But to continue to try to nurture that relationship, to keep her, you know, involved with him, mm-hmm. is where he lost the lead, man. That's where everything fell apart for him, that nobody was going to see him as even potentially being innocent, because who does that?
Right.
Other than a fucking narcissistic sociopath.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just like, this guy couldn't control himself. You know, you figure, okay, well, my wife's gone missing, which, again, is a problem.
Yeah.
Like, you can't discount that.
Right.
The fact that,
like, he's continuing to do that just shows where his state of mind was, you know? And I mean, he owns that these days, you know, in terms of saying, you know, I was a fucking piece of shit.
Yeah.
I think I was a sex addict, whatever, you know, whatever his excuses are. But, you know, again, the thing that's important to remember here is whether or not the guy got a fair trial.
That's the point.
When you start looking at this shit, I mean, the die was cast, and it all starts with that thing about Amber. When Amber comes forward and mm-hmm. fucking flamethrows him, that was it. Everybody in everybody's mind, he's the guy. It doesn't really matter what they put out there in terms mm-hmm. of the trial, in terms of evidence. And it was,
If the Amber part didn't exist, this looks very shady and bizarre. I'm sorry, let me interrupt you, Stacey.
No, that's okay. What I was going to say was that that's the hard part of this, is that he is such a piece of shit.
Right.
As a human being, that it's really hard to decipher between the cold facts and what's been revealed here, and not contrast it to this guy's just a piece of shit cheating on his pregnant wife and then continuing after she's dead, because right. You're just that much of a POS, you know?
Right. I mean,
and the reality is with that sort of thinking, and I get it. We all feel that way. But the reality is, if we just dig into that narrative and then he's a piece of shit, he deserves to go down no matter what, well, then you're ignoring the other piece of shit that killed this pregnant right. woman.
Just for
the vitriol of ourselves feeling good that right. he's going down. Great, but there's a piece of shit over here that killed that woman.
Right.
And we feel good inside. We think we got the guy, but no, we're really letting someone get away with murder. And again, all theoretical. I'm neutral on this. I'm just kind of looking at it from all angles, but that's how we work as humans, because we want to fill in the blanks. We want to have the answers. When we don't have the answers, we're going to go with the path of least resistance. And the path of least resistance is Scott Peterson killed his wife because he was out fishing that day. And lo and behold, they found the body out that way. Well, also lo and behold, if somebody else knew he was out fishing there that day, was witness to her catching them in a burglary that they did not want to get caught for, and one of those many men had the wise idea of, she's going to fucking talk. We better silence her. And how do we make this look? Well, people are going to naturally think it's him. He's already said he was out fishing. Go put the body there. That's not rocket science. That's a criminal mind, the way of thinking of how they're going to handle this to deflect the blame away. And it worked perfectly, if that's exactly what happened.
So doesn't it mean he is just the most unlucky fucker you've ever met in your life?
He's the unluckiest fucking guy of all time. Him and Richard Allen are the two unlucky dudes. It's ultimately at the end of the day, because we could keep going. This thing was 600 pages long, right?
I know.
And there's a lot of shit in there. Okay. I mean, when you start getting into the witnesses that are adamant that they saw Lacey after the time Scott's gone, which was 9:30 in the morning, you know, and you start piling this shit on and you see what the cops lied about. You know, look, you've got all these things in your favor if the cops are, you know, dead set that he's the guy, in terms of, like, you could, if you're a cop who likes Scott Peterson, you could not ask for anything more perfect than this guy having a girlfriend and continuing to try to bang her after his wife's gone missing. I mean, you couldn't have anything go more your way than that particular set of circumstances. That is like a gift from God if you're the cops and they're prosecutor. You're like, holy shit. Thank you, Scott Peterson. You're fucked, buddy. Because the entire world hates you now because you're a giant flaming piece of shit. You have to, and I know how hard it is. And like Tony said, we all understand that. And we all feel the same way about Scott Peterson. He's not a good dude. You have to be able to put that aside in order to honestly look at this thing and just say, okay, I want to see whether or not he got a fair trial. And if he didn't, let's have a fair trial and see where it fucking lands. With all the evidence, with all the shit that the cops got rid of, with all the people that they lied about in terms of what their statements were, let's have it all come in and figure it out. I mean, because ultimately we want to know the truth, right?
Yeah. And anytime you have the words destruction of evidence entering the zeitgeist of a case, that's not going to bode well for the truth, no matter what that truth actually is. And the reality is, in this case, there's several chapters to this book that were ripped out and the jury never saw and the public never saw or ignored because it didn't fit with how they emotionally felt as they were consuming the information as it came from the mouth of Nancy Grace. The orchestrated destruction of evidence, the May 6th through the 7th meeting, this is a big one. On May 6th of 2003, detectives met about the Medina burglary discovery and what to turn over. This is a burglary that's happening across the street. This is the one that Lacey allegedly stumbled upon, whether she was confronting them or just out for the walk. Hey, what you guys up to? Whatever that scenario may have been. On May 7th, the next day, it was marked for destruction. The videotaped interviews of the burglars, Todd and Pierce, and the stolen Medina safe. Why would you destroy that information? Why would you destroy the evidence before the trial? In a case like this, where, you know, anything is a possibility, you may need this down the road if you don't get a conviction on Scott Peterson, because they didn't have one yet. If you're looking for the truth, why on earth would you be destroying any other piece of information that could help you solve this case, other than because it doesn't play with your current narrative that you're pushing and you don't want to be wrong?
Right. Well, you just answered the question.
Exactly.
That's why they fucking destroyed it.
That's why they did it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it should piss people off. You know, I mean, it really should. They destroyed, like you said, the taped interviews with both Todd and Pierce. They destroyed the Medina safe. I mean, why the fuck would they do that? You know, it's like, what is there? Was this in the back of the van and Lacey's back there, and the thing had some kind of fingerprints / DNA on it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like, why?
And answer me this. How the fuck does Lacey's watch get pawned by an associate of the burglars? How? If Scott killed her, dumped her in a lake, or they just happened to be out fishing there too one day, and oh shit, a watch, let's go pawn this.
It's so fucking weird, man.
That part doesn't seem to make any sense either. But again, this part, this piece of the case, another piece nobody heard about. The jury didn't hear about it, nobody heard about it, but it's there. It's a fact. It's an inconvenient fact if you think Scott Peterson is guilty, but it's a fact.
Yeah.
And if we're playing in the realm of reality on reality's terms, it kind of makes you think a little bit differently. I mean, what are the odds of that? What are the odds that an associate of the burglars pawns her fucking watch if they had nothing to do with her death?
It's a problem.
It's a fucking problem. And if people don't know what we're talking about, so Lacey had this gold Croton watch that she had inherited from her grandmother when she passed. And that was never found at the house. All right. And on 24th, Scott had told one of the detectives that Lacey was wearing the wristwatch that had diamonds all around the face when he left the house. So when Scott says he leaves, Lacey's wearing the watch. And then all of Lacey's watches, when they go and kind of do inventory of her shit, you know, because obviously they're going to try to figure out, number one, if you know, the unlikely situation or circumstance that Lacey dipped, right? Like, she's not dipping on fucking Christmas Eve day. But they're going to take an inventory, make sure all her clothes are still there, that she didn't just like fucking like jet, you know? So they go and they see all her other watches aside from the Croton watch. And then this Grogan, who's the detective, he spends months investigating the missing watch in 2003. He says he goes to all the pawn shops, and specifically this Brooks Pawn and Jewelry, where Lacey sold some of her other grandmother's stuff, but they don't have a Croton there. Okay. And then he meets with Lacey's family, like her aunt, Robin, and she confirms that it's a watch with diamonds around the face. And then again, they check Scott's eBay activity to see if the thing was sold. The Croton was listed for $750. It never sold. Goes to the jeweler that Lacey used and repaired the watch at one point. They don't have the Croton. And like ultimately, they end up searching for one. So after he goes through all the family shit, goes through all the places that she would have normally have gone with the watch to get it repaired, Grogan asks another cop, he's like, look, search the Modesto Police Department, like pawn records, okay? And see if you have anything come up for, you know, Croton diamond watch. And one pops up at the pawn shop in Modesto, which is like 3 miles away from the house. And So they go over there, and the pawn was, it was pawned by this Deanna Renfro for $20 on December 31st of 2002. I mean, that's, so Grogan writes in his report that the slip does not appear to match the description of Lacey's croton. So he starts fucking lying about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like immediately, like this croton is, it's clearly the watch.
Doesn't fit the narrative.
It does not fit the narrative.
We got to lie. Yeah. It doesn't fit the narrative.
And he stops. Like immediately after he finds this information out, he's like, okay, I'm good. I'm not going to look any more into this shit. Yeah. He doesn't visually examine the watch. He doesn't photograph the watch. He doesn't collect the watch. Like, so he sees the fucking watch at the pawn shop and just like dips. He's like, I'm good.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
And then you have an orange van up in flames near the house with what they believe was a blood-stained mattress.
Yeah.
An arson fire on this van. The police did take photos, videos, and reports. None of it surfaces for 10 years.
Yeah.
And you have a murder right not far away. I mean, obviously there wasn't a body in the van, but if you got Lacey in there and you killed her and you want to get rid of the evidence of that piece of the crime and you go take the body to the lake, which we happen to know Scott was fishing at, let's go dump her where everybody thinks Scott might have been. And we don't look at the van. We don't, I mean, what? Again, doesn't fit the narrative. So let's pretend it has nothing to do with it or that it didn't happen. It seems to be how this has played out.
Yeah, and frankly, the van doesn't fit real neatly with the new data either, though.
You know, how so?
It's like, well, because the van was discovered on the 26th.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's unless she was transferred to a different vehicle. You know,
I'm wondering if they kept her captive for a bit or something.
Well, what I'm saying is if the van's on fire on the 26th and the new data is that
for the baby,
right, you know, that the baby was killed on that mean date of the 1st, that means that these guys would have kept her alive for a few days. Maybe, you know, what the fuck do we do? I don't want to fucking, I'm not going to fucking kill a pregnant woman. Fuck you, dude. I didn't sign up for that. You know, whatever that internal battle might have been with these dudes. If that's the case, if that's what happened here. So, you know, because they had found blood on that mattress in this van, right? And like the last time this thing came up in court, they were trying to test multiple things found in that van because there was a unknown male profile found in there. So they wanted to be able to do the testing on that. And I think the judge back then allowed them to analyze and test one thing. But in terms of for the defense, they don't need to prove shit. Like this isn't about that, you know? So, but like, that's going to be pushback for people that are like, because this van's orange, right? And like, there were people that saw this other, you know, people that are claiming they saw the Medina van for the burglary, and there were people that were saying it was white, you know? So you've got some conflict with what color the van was and what certain people that were witnesses are claiming that what color the van was and what this van was. So, I mean, but it's still, again, you know, why aren't you investigating it fully is the bigger question.
When everything's chaotic, you can't just start dismissing things when the chaos hasn't settled yet.
Yeah.
You can't just be like, well, no, you have to take it all. You have to let it settle. You have to see what all this is. Because if you don't, well, you end up like this. Nearly 25 years later, we're going, what the hell did you all do? And you have Brady violations where it's a suppression of favorable evidence. I'm just going to go through this list here. It's a lot of the stuff we had already talked about. But when you put it into context like this, it makes you go, oh, okay. You got the January 2nd videotapes. That's the conversations with the burglars. Destroyed. Like, why are you destroying? We saw that in the Richard Allen case why are you destroying the video to evidence? Oh, yeah, you taped over him accidentally. Sure. Right. That's the story. So you have this destroyed with the other possible perpetrators here. You have the safe, the Medina safe from across the street destroyed. The Croton watch investigation hidden. The police admissions that they lied about verifying the burglars' alibis. Interviews with the Medinas confirming the January 24th burglary. The burned van and the blood evidence. The jailhouse informant James Romano's 2003 report about burglars' admissions and the watch. Witness proof that Lacey knew about the boat. Lieutenant Aponte's recorded inmate calls linking the burglars to Lacey. There's a lot here. In open court, prosecutor Bergant Flagg admitted they withheld evidence because they didn't like the defense investigator. It's I mean, what the fuck?
That guy's a dick. That guy's a fucking total dick. We're not giving him shit. Get out.
like that's what? How we do a case. I don't like you. My personality doesn't flow well with you, so I'm going to hold back shit that actually matters.
Yeah.
I think Scott Peterson is deserving of a new trial.
Yeah. I mean, if he's the culprit, I mean, it's sad.
But you know, let's do it fair. Let's do it fair with the right information.
We have a choice, Tony. We're going to choose to live under our Constitution, which we have to, it's the backbone of our country. Without it, we have nothing. The country falls apart. We're in fucking utter chaos. And the thing applies to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Like giant flaming pieces of shit and the sweetest human being you've ever met. Every single person, the thing applies to all of us that are you know, living in this country. So, I mean, if he didn't get a fair trial, which... Again, like, look, we're looking at the defense side of this.
Okay? Sure.
So the state may have to respond. I mean, that's the first step in this thing. The court is going to determine whether or not they think there's enough here that it warrants the state to respond to it. So they could say, they could look through this 600 pages and say, you know, we've heard some of this shit before. You know, like... We don't think that it's enough. We think that they're still going to find it. The jury still would have found him guilty, even if all of this was true. And they have to, when they're looking at this, I'm talking about the appellate court, they have to look at it and accept everything is true in this. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's their mindset. So they have to fix their brain to say, okay, because that's the standard. They're looking at it and everything has to be accepted in this new petition as being true. So that's the jump off point for them. So they're saying, okay, assuming that everything is true, we still aren't convinced that any of this would have had an impact on the jury. I find that to be difficult to believe that they would come to that conclusion based on everything that we've been talking about. And there's more. There's 600 pages of shit, man.
Yeah, there's a lot in here.
Ultimately, I think what they're going to requires that the state does respond to this, because what this thing is going to take 2 years, 3 years to play out. So they'll have time to respond. It's obviously a massive petition. State's going to have to do a fuck ton of work to respond to it. They're going to have to find their own experts in order to refute claims that they're making. And then, you know, once they respond, the defense then gets the opportunity to reply. And after that's all done, when it's been fully briefed, then the court will decide whether or not there's going to be a full evidentiary hearing.
Mm-hmm.
And at that hearing, after the hearing, that's when they will decide. I mean, they could, after the thing is fully briefed, they could decide to give him a new trial just based on the papers.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the more likely scenario would be that they would grant this evidentiary hearing, which, as you can imagine, would be quite the spectacle.
Yeah.
You know.
Can he get a fair trial with all of the coverage from his previous trial and now this? Does he even get a fair shake, or is it just more about the process that he deserves all of the evidence to be brought forth?
You know who's the best to ask? Let's ask the chat. Like, what do you guys say? So if you haven't heard any of this, and we're talking directly to you guys out there in the chat, where are you at on this? If you hadn't heard of the new stuff, and if you're able to, for a moment, to put aside that Scott is a fucking scumbag, okay? Like, personally, he's a scumbag. We're just trying to figure out if he got a fair trial. If you've looked at all this and you're like, okay, you're making me think about it in terms of the new stuff. All right. Like maybe this dude didn't get a fair trial. So then assume that he didn't and he's going to get a fair trial. Would you guys in the chat be able to put aside the fact that he's a fucking scumbag,
right,
and just go by the evidence as presented at the case because, or at the trial, because you can't take into consideration that he's a scumbag in terms of determining whether or not he's innocent or guilty of the crime?
I'm going to say this. This happened, you know, 20 some years ago now. We all were around for it. We all remember it because we were alive. You got a good chunk of the population that has no memory of this. This is in the history books. They didn't pay attention to it then. It would not have the impact that it had on us because remember it, or they didn't exist.
Right.
Yeah.
You could have a juror on this that is younger than Connor would have been. The baby that could be a potential juror on this case. So I'm going to say, yes, I think he can get a fair trial if you have a good mix of jurors, because I think you're going to have at least a fourth of that, if not a third of that, that weren't even alive when this shit happened.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you are going to have a more unbiased look at this as opposed, I mean, if you tried this 5 years after he was convicted, 10 years after he's convicted, no, I think it'd be very, very difficult. At this point in time, this is ancient fucking history.
Yeah.
This is the only people who remember, who pay attention, to the people who remember it, that remember all the vitriol about it. To most kids, most young adults, who's Scott Peterson? I've heard of him. My mom talked about it once.
Yeah, and Tony, you make a fucking amazing point. And if you're both sides, if you're the defense and the prosecution, you want an entire jury filled with people under 23 years old. The entire jury should be people that were not alive when this case took place, if both sides really want a fair trial.
I mean, or they can be in their, if you were a small child, you won't remember this. So you can get into the 30s. Yeah. People in their early 30s would not remember most of this.
100%. Like, you know? So I agree with you. I think that they could. Now, Kim French, are you basing that on evidence or that base? Like, I always want to ask this question. And I'm not sitting here that I think that, you know, Scott Peterson's innocent. Okay. That is not part of my evaluation. All I'm trying to figure out is if the guy got a fair trial. But what I always want to ask are people that are so dead set that he's fucking guilty, is it because you hate him because he's a horrible person and because he was cheating on his wife prior to her dying?
Yeah.
And after she goes missing, he continues to continue to cheat on her. Like, is that what drives people to just put aside things that are fucked up with this trial and just say, fuck him, he's guilty, I hate him.
That's not a sound, accurate, or safe way of evaluating anything. That's basing it on emotion. And I get the emotion.
It's a human way.
It is, but it's not the accurate way. If we were just basing everything on the human way, we'd still be burning witches.
It is Halloween week.
Yeah,
true.
Yeah.
But right. if we're basing on that, we'd be doing that. We'd be throwing people in on the days that they're not doing NFL games. We'd be letting lions loose into the stadiums and having them devour criminals. Lights. If we're doing it the human way, but we've evolved. That. You know, that's the thing. You know,
yeah.
And I get it, but it's just, it's where you got to take the step back and like this. Same with the Adelsons. I hate that woman, and she triggers me in so many ways, and many, many people. But the evidence there, we've all looked at every piece of it, and it's fucking damning. But there was something else, if there was something that lifted her out of that said, okay, you need to look at it because it needs to be fair. Just because someone's a shitty human being doesn't mean they murdered somebody, and it doesn't mean they'd be locked away for the rest of their lives because he was cheating on his wife and still trying to actively get some while she's missing. Yes, that is a piece of shit move. But you know what? Karma, the world, it comes back to collect on narcissists. And maybe that is the world that did come back and karma coming back and collecting on him by putting him away in prison for all of these years. But even if that didn't happen, those things have a way of working themselves out with people like that. And it doesn't necessarily take our intervention and our anger and our emotion to have to be stacked up to take them out. They take themselves out. They always do.
Always do.
Yes, yeah, Kim,
like Kim, you're saying that you're basing it on everything, in my opinion, but what we're trying to tell you is that the things that you're basing it on were incorrect and no. or not put into evidence and or tampered with or lied about. Like that's the whole point of this thing is, you know, everybody deserves a fair trial. If the state's got the goods, then fucking bring it. Bring the case, but do it fairly. Don't cheat. Don't destroy evidence. Bring it on the facts.
I want to hear the other side. I want to hear the state's rebuttal. What is the rebuttal? And it has to be fucking legitimate. It just can't be because we did it that way. Because because he didn't like the defense attorney. Like, that's insane. It's insane to think that this is, but it is. And the reality is, this is a system run by humans, and humans do play a role in it. But that's where we have to be objective, and you need people that are not super connected to go, wait a second. No. We want to make this fair. That's not an okay way of looking at this. We need to look at this and deal with reality on reality's terms, something that I don't think most people that are out here in the world are very good at, ourselves included, because we all have emotions. But that's where you got to take that step back and pull the emotions out
of
it. That's not an easy thing to do. Not an easy thing to do.
It's very, very hard. It is very difficult, man.
fascinating information on this case. And honest to God, I didn't know what to expect going into it. I saw you and Allie doing this the other day, and I had a chance to watch a little bit. I'm like, oh, this is really interesting. So I was really wanting to talk to you about this, and I'm glad we did, because it really opened up my eyes on this when it's put into perspective like this. Yeah. Everybody, give me your thoughts in the comments. If you're watching this, you know, on the replay and all that, I'd love to get your feedback, because it is, I'm looking at this in a very different way than I have in the past. Your thoughts in the comments on YouTube, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. If you're not already there, you can make that same search wherever you get podcasts, so you can find us wherever you go. It's going to wrap it up. Until next time, Bob Bonner for Defense Diaries. Go check out his podcast.
Inside the John Wayne Gacy investigation.
Yes. Buried, the John Wayne Gacy. Yes.
Thank you.
Go check that out right now. It is amazing. And it really tells that story from a perspective you've never heard before. Buried. Check that out there. All right. That's going to wrap it up for Stacey, for Todd. I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Hey, I'm Patrick.
And I'm Jillian.
We've been making the True Crime Obsessed podcast for almost 9 years now.
Yeah, each week on TCO, we tell a riveting true crime story by recapping a documentary about the case.
With nearly 400 million downloads and over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, we can say with confidence that if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now might be the time to give us a try.
We cover the cases everyone is talking about and also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
Find True Crime Obsessed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
The holidays are here, and that means it's the most wonderful time of the year to save with Rakuten. Use Rakuten to stack cash back at your favorite stores on top of holiday sales. That's savings on savings. With Rakuten, you can get cash back on gifts for everyone on your list. From toys for the kids to kitchen gear for the person who loves to cook to electronics for everyone. You can even save on something for yourself. Just shop the stores you love, and cash back is automatically added to your account. And you can get paid with gift cards, PayPal, or check. Or eligible American Express card members can even choose to earn membership rewards points instead of cash back. It's truly a no-brainer. Join for free today and get a new member bonus after minimum qualifying purchases. Just go to Rakuten.com, download the app, or install the browser extension. That's Rakuten. Terms and conditions apply.
Extra Value Meals are back. That means 10 tender juicy McNuggets and medium fries and a drink are just $8. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
Hey, I'm Patrick.
And I'm Jillian.
We've been making the True Crime Obsessed podcast for almost 9 years now.
Yeah, each week on TCO, we tell a riveting true crime story by recapping a documentary about the case.
With nearly 400 million downloads and over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, we can say with confidence that if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now might be the time to give us a try.
We cover the cases everyone is talking about and also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
Find True Crime Obsessed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Hey, I'm Patrick.
And I'm Jillian.
We've been making the True Crime Obsessed podcast for almost 9 years now.
Yeah, each week on TCO, we tell a riveting true crime story by recapping a documentary about the case.
With nearly 400 million downloads and over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, we can say with confidence that if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now might be the time to give us a try.
We cover the cases everyone is talking about and also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
Find True Crime Obsessed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Hey, I'm Patrick.
And I'm Jillian.
We've been making the True Crime Obsessed podcast for almost 9 years now.
Yeah, each week on TCO, we tell a riveting true crime story by recapping a documentary about the case.
With nearly 400 million downloads and over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, we can say with confidence that if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now might be the time to give us a try.
We cover the cases everyone is talking about and also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
Find True Crime Obsessed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Hey, I'm Patrick.
And I'm Jillian.
We've been making the True Crime Obsessed podcast for almost 9 years now.
Yeah, each week on TCO, we tell a riveting true crime story by recapping a documentary about the case.
With nearly 400 million downloads and over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, we can say with confidence that if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now might be the time to give us a try.
We cover the cases everyone is talking about and also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
Find True Crime Obsessed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Hey, I'm Patrick.
And I'm Jillian.
We've been making the True Crime Obsessed podcast for almost 9 years now.
Yeah, each week on TCO, we tell a riveting true crime story by recapping a documentary about the case.
With nearly 400 million downloads and over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, we can say with confidence that if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now might be the time to give us a try.
We cover the cases everyone is talking about and also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
Find True Crime Obsessed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.